Welcome to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Ewlings Fund for visual artists. The Clark Ewlings Fund exists to provide training, introductions, and funding for working artists to turn working artists into thriving artists. I'm Daniel DeGree, your host. Our guest today is Ghost of a Dream, a moniker for the collaborative duo Adam Ekstrom and Lauren Waz. Now, their work consists of large sculptural installations, collages, and immersive texts made from lottery tickets, romance novels, playing cards, and other raw or discarded materials. Ghost of a Dream is working on a project they call the Fair Housing Project. They've created a house from art fair materials, which they've immersed in a sea of fog and filmed documentary style. The house and the film will be shown in September at Smack Mellon. They are also Clark Ewlings Fund 2015 Business Accelerator Grant recipients, which means they participate in the educational program of the fund, and they're also receiving critical funding for the Fair Housing Project. Welcome to the show. Can you take a minute to tell us a little bit more in your own words about your collaboration as an artistic team?
Sure, I can start that off. Adam and I started working together in 2007. We started working by collecting lottery tickets that we found on the ground. Go ahead, Adam.
We would take our dog for walks around Ridgewood, Queens, is where we lived at the time, and we started picking up lottery tickets because they were kind of these beautiful objects on the ground, and then just started talking about what we could do with them.
And we're thinking about dreams that people had and how people attained those dreams. And so since then, our sort of vision has been looking at how people try to attain their dreams and what materials they use to try to get them there.
Now, you're currently working on the Fair Housing Project, as we said, and this involved creating a house from discarded art fair materials specifically. So can you tell me more about how you came up with that idea and why? Why art fair materials?
For a number of years, we were working at art fairs. And at the end of the fair, we always see this kind of mountain of trash. Everybody brings artwork with themselves or to a bunch of different people. And these new crates need to be made, so crates are left over every time there's a fair. There's carpet used, and then that gets left over, new carpet every time. So many materials. And every time we walk through, we say to each other, you could build a house from each time this happens. And it happens, you know, every week somewhere.
And so as we were thinking that, we started to slowly collect these materials, and we found everything from, as Adam said, carpet, to lighting materials, to furniture, foam and wood, and all sorts of stuff. And we've been squirreling that away for years, just waiting for the opportunity to come to build our little dream house out of that material. Art fairs are this thing that we all depend on that money. You know, galleries are making over three quarters of their annual sales with money that they've, you know, with sales from art fairs. And so we know that they're a very important part of the system that we're all involved in. So it's also a hard thing because they're a challenging way to see art, both for environmental reasons and just seeing that much art packed into one space.
They're also kind of a necessary evil for us because they are what pays quite a few artists' bills, you know? Like, if it weren't for the art fair, there'd be a lot less sales. And it also, you know, it packs a lot of art in, so it's not very great at seeing any individual work of art, but also somebody can come in and see, you know, 500 different artists within a couple hours.
From
so
all
it's
over
a
the
double-edged
world,
sword.
Too.
So it's hard to tell whether... And this is what I was going to ask. It's hard to tell whether there is some sense in which it is social commentary on the environment, social commentary on the art world and the prevalence and relevance of shows, or it's sort of just more playfulness and tongue-in-cheek. So I guess I want to ask you how you feel about art fairs in general.
I mean, I think that we're torn, you know, because it's this place that you can walk in and see artists from every corner of the world. You know, I'm not going to get to go see a gallery in South Africa, probably, you know, but I can go to Fries per se and see it once a year, you know, and go back and visit that same gallery and see their staple of artists. And as an artist myself, my work gets out there to collectors that would never have the chance to come to New York or gallery in Paris. So,
but at the same time, you don't ever see any of these galleries' spaces by going to a fair, and you're seeing a small curated group of what they show, and you're usually seeing, at most fairs, you're seeing a number of the artists all together that maybe aren't having a conversation with one another. So you're not going and experiencing an artwork. You're going and seeing a bunch of things.
Yeah, it's like a barrage of so much imagery and information all at once.
Well, now, your original project, it's centered around placing this house on a frozen lake and then filming it as it sunk, actually. But because of weather, that was impossible. So you immersed the house in a sea of fog instead. So how did you decide on this path? What were the key challenges to reconceptualizing the project? And, of course, anyone that's ever run a project knows that, you know, things change in your environment. That affects the project. How did you roll with those changes?
I think our main objective was having the image of this house on video somehow disappear, about this disappearance and reappearance of this house sort of fading in and out. And
but
so
for it to happen now, to force it through, we wanted to do it through the forces of nature in one way or another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so when the ice, we tried so hard with the ice that we had some of the warmest winters on record, the ice just wouldn't get thick enough to allow the house to get out to the middle of the lake. So we decided fog was the next best thing to film it in this natural environment. We have 8 cameras circling the house, and so we have it surrounded from every angle and just waiting for that fog to come and roll in, envelop it.
So, Lauren, let me ask you this. Do you feel that you've learned anything critical about project management from this experience that'll help you in the future with other large-scale projects?
Sure, yeah. I guess just learning to roll with the punches. We were obsessively checking the weather every 2 minutes and just realizing that the best project is going to come out no matter, you know, if you put your heart into it. So while we didn't get what we first envisioned, I think this fog is a better solution in a way.
Now, this is a Clark Healings Fund funded project. So what were the costs involved that the Business Accelerator grant helped defray?
Adam, you want to go with that?
A lot of it was movement, getting all of the materials. Like, we got a truck load of crates from Art Fair, from our handling company. And then we had to get video equipment, actually a home security camera system, which is the best way to do something like this, to get along recordings without having to be there constantly to check the memory and the battery. And then more movement at the end of the materials of the house.
Yeah, we built the house in Mosaic, and then we had to transfer it to another location. And then we have to transfer it to the gallery, and then we'll be transferring it back to Mosaic. So U-Haul is getting a significant portion of our budget for this project.
So there were a lot of logistics and technology costs. Now, Clark Healings Fund likes to support artists at crucial or pivotal moments in their career. So why was this particular project pivotal or crucial to your career?
I think this is the longest project we've ever worked on. I mean, this project it'll span a couple years from collection to fruition. Wouldn't you agree, Lauren?
Yeah, I think that... you know, a lot of our work takes the time is not only in the building of the actual objects, but the collection point is huge for us, because every material we use has been refuse in one way or another. So all of the collection is you know, a huge part of our studio time. So this project, I think, yeah, just putting the years that have gone into researching and collection and then just making it happen with the weather and getting it polished too.
Maybe pivotal in our discussion too. I mean, quite often we're talking about One Hope and Dream with one material, but this, I feel like the conversations we're crossing are like three or four major conversations, you know, the art world, art fairs, the environment, the idea of artwork being the new real estate. Like, this is kind of like a larger conversation than we usually take on, possibly. And the idea that we're making our own video with collected materials rather than just collecting video, which is how we've made videos previously. I think those are two like big changes.
But I guess also I'm wondering how it's critical from a business standpoint. So for instance, what do you hope to gain career-wise? In other words, is it PR? Do you hope to gain money from this? Is it a sales thing? Are you trying to carve out a particular brand definition? What is the business outcome that you're aiming for?
I think the most exciting part is the lack of having to worry about sales for this project. We're going to be showing this at SMACMO in this fall, and they're a nonprofit and not worried about sales in general. That being said, we have many beautiful things to sell. I think that receiving grants from them and from you all, and it sort of freed us up from having to worry about the sales as much, and just being able to focus on the what this project is, the sort of critical moments of this project.
And our hope is to get some attention for how much work we've put into this project. It's like a broader scan than usual. It took us longer than usual, and not having to have as many commercial viable work from there, I think is, I don't know where I'm going with this.
Well, I think we're also organizing a panel discussion around the project. So we're trying to get lots of conversations happening around the project. And hopefully the media will take note of that as well.
Yeah, so we're trying to guide a conversation that's recently started in the critical world. You know, a few people have written about this dilemma with the art fairs, but we're kind of trying to be a big player in this conversation and make works that like involves the conversation. Because we feel like there's not been much work made about it, even though there has been a few key articles written about it. I've never seen an exhibition involving it, and we're calling attention to it more, hopefully, by having this exhibition.
Well, the reason I ask is, of course, the Clark Healings Fund loves it when artists get to pursue their dream, but it's not really why we exist, to help people sort of explore issues they want to explore or be free, you know, from having to worry about money. That isn't our objective at all, but our objective is really to help them grow their careers and further their professional development so that they can be thriving artists as working artists. That's really sort of what we're looking for.
I think that's ultimately what I think we feel is happening through this project, that we're making this big project in order to gain some sort of critical acclaim for it.
Good. So then there's a PR element. That's certainly our take on it. When we've talked, obviously, you guys being recipients, we've talked about this multiple times, and our take has always been the massive PR potential of this compared to almost any other art activity, you know, that we've seen recently. Obviously, there's some pretty amazing exhibitions and installations that people have done. But, you know, when you include a documentary with it, it's sort of like you're covering all the bases. It's kind of a PR snafu. So we expect you to get wide coverage. So, Adam, maybe you can answer this one. Logistically and financially, how do you manage a project of this scale and this magnitude? You know, what are the components that go into it? Cause it's a lot like managing a big construction
project. Yeah, I mean, we plan from the beginning, but we never think of all the aspects. So as we're working, more things come in that we didn't plan. Maybe that's just kind of what happens with an artist. We try our hardest to plan from the beginning, but like our ideas change and then the expenses change as it goes through it. But it's always worth it because the ideas changing, it seemed to make the project better every time. I don't know if that's answering your question.
Sure. Well, now, how has Smack Melon helped with the ongoing promotion of the project? Have you done any of your independent promotion or left it all up to them?
They've actually ran an ad in Modern Painter, and they have had some email blasts, and we have mostly spent our time as far as promoting aspects of the project through Instagram, just details, maybe a painting, a piece of furniture, a still from the video.
We also have a large mailer that we send out and have been promoting it for almost a year now.
How's the promotion going? What have been the results?
People respond really positively to the objects and the images, and it seems, you know, we even tagged the fairs that the pieces are come from, and it seems like they are, I don't know, liking the images.
Instagram is awesome because it's so quick and can get things out, but it's also a little bit harder to describe an in-depth piece like this through Instagram. So I feel like we're doing like teasers in a way through our Instagram promotion.
I feel like it works because when we're out in public, people are asking us about the project a lot, like referencing images they saw and then want to like talk about exactly what's happening with the project and what the piece is about.
Now, part of the Accelerator Grant program at Clark Ealing's Fund is tuition to our educational workshop series. And of course, you're attending those monthly workshops, the both of you. So can you tell us whether that's adding value to you as an artistic team and your project planning? And if so, how?
For sure. I think that we've been really excited about the attending these workshops. I'm really looking forward to the one with the lawyer coming up and the accountant, because I think those are two big sort of blanks missing in our arts education, is about financing, about dealing with tax issues, and some other questions for the lawyer.
Yeah, the dialogue's been great. I look forward to the same two regarding copyright and trademark.
I think those are going to be really popular workshops. Of course, we've done them on marketing, communications for artists. We've done them on business strategy for artists. I mean, it's going to be great. We do these, have one on sales. I'm really excited. I know that the rest of the team seems to be really enthusiastic. So tell us, let's go ahead and pivot then and talk a little bit about financials and business, since you mentioned accounting and the money side of it, et cetera. But first, as a transition, tell us about Dream Car. Dream Car is a beautiful and interesting project. One of your other projects, I think you started before the fair housing one. What do we need to know about that?
It's actually the first project we did. So we're collecting those lottery tickets and doing research, and we researched the three things people dream about and then buy if they win the lottery. So the car, a home, and a vacation. And so our first project was the Dream Car, which initially was called Ghost of a Dream. And we made a full-scale Hummer out of as many tickets as it cost to buy a Hummer, which was $39,000 at the time. And it was the last year of production of that car. And then, in theory, all the way through to selling it to the museum for that much.
So this is really consistent. This commentary that you're doing sort of on disposable materials and on the concept of waste. I mean, it carries through in this project and it carries through in the Fair Housing Project. I'm fascinated by what else you might have up your sleeves if you're going to keep going down this path.
I don't know that it's so much waste. I mean, I guess in the Fair Housing Project, it definitely is. But with the other ones, it's more like, I guess it's waste, but in another way. It's wasted money or wasted dreams as people sort of put their hope in something and it sort of flutters away. But our constant sort of mantra is to find those things that people dream about, to look for those materials that people have touched and held and fraught over, and then use those in the building of our project. So we've worked with everything from trophies that have been put up on Craigslist to clips from Hollywood films, to playing cards that have been used in casinos and then get sent to prisons for prisoners to sort them and then end up back in the gift shop.
Well, it's exciting that, you know, the museum bought this piece. And it also, it just reminds me of something I saw many years ago in the 80s. I think it was a song that somebody had written called 39 Lawnmowers, about the fact that the average city block, there are 39 lawnmowers on a residential block, you know, and they're used about an average of 10 minutes a week a piece. And so if you add all that up, they will rust away long before their usable life has been exploited. And if there was just one lawnmower and everybody checked it out of a community garage and used it when they needed it, that would take care of all 39 of those houses quite easily in its life, right? And so what you're doing is, I don't remember who sang the song, what you're doing, it just reminds me of that. It's very similar. I want to ask you then about the financial side of it, though. It's exciting that you sold the work, but you can consistently create these large-scale sculptural pieces. How do you budget for these projects that take so many months to complete, and how do you subsidize your costs?
That's why we're working at art fairs for a while. Like, we were doing this side work to fund our project and our life. But we had a number of jobs that kind of played into what we end up making in the end.
Yeah, and we've used residencies as a way to get that time away and have housing that's paid for to be able to make these big projects. And also, we have been lucky to have some galleries that help fund some of these big projects.
Now, you know, how do you plan then for the unintended lags in sales? I mean, while you're working on these projects, you're not necessarily selling other work. So do you have some kind of plan for ensuring that your business model ultimately is sustainable? You have sort of bread and butter taken care of. Is the art show really it? And I guess the other aspect of it is, can you create this kind of art foreseeably for your lifetime, the life of your career? Or at some point, are you going to need to switch and focus on a different medium or smaller works that sell more rapidly?
I think that we're always working with sort of three different methodologies. We're always working on something big. We have something big cooking, some big installation. We're working on smaller drawings that can be sold easily, and they actually fulfill us in the day-to-day. And then we do collage-based work that is anything from 20 by 30 to 12 by, I don't know, 18 feet. So we're trying to always move between the super huge and something that's more accessible to anyone. And that seems to help with our business model, because we're able to get people really excited by these huge projects, but then also have something that you can put in your living room. And to us, I think they're both really exciting to do.
And we're good at planning with our money. So we make a big sale, that just affords us more time in the studio, and we can be economical about, you know, not spending too much and making it last, squirreling it away. And I feel like the struggle sometimes kind of promotes better work sometimes.
Now, you know, that side of business, cutting costs, is pretty critical at times when you're stretched. But there's also the other side of the business, which is going after profit or seeking to make enough capital that you can really drive the business and sustain it. So I want to ask you how you manage the sort of administrative side of the artwork, relationship management, inventory tracking, you know, contracts, the side of things that grow your audience, convince them to invest or buy your work, and maintain all those relationships over time. How do you do that? What's your program?
I think that there's something really lucky about having two of us working together, because one person can be focused on that for part of the day while the other person's getting work and it's done in the studio. Adam's definitely better at that stuff than I am. So maybe I should let you talk, darling.
It's all right. I mean, we do all right at it. I feel like we could do better. A lot of our inventory is in our head and on a notebook, but we've slowly been working on the inventory system for a while. And we try to maintain good relationships. There's a book out there by Heather Darcy Bandhari that has actually been pivotal in our career, titled Artworks. We tell a lot of people, a lot of students, especially, and other artists to get the book. We've kind of used that book as a model for some of our inventory and some of our contracts.
Now, you revealed something to the audience, which is that you're not just a collaborative duo, but you're also a romantic couple. And so maybe we can now take the license of asking you, what is it like? What are the challenges in working together as a romantic couple? I can't imagine that it's friction-free and there's never any disagreement and that everything is smooth as butter.
No.
Definitely tough for both of us, right? We used to have a rule that we wouldn't talk about a ghost of a dream inside the bedroom, or like even inside the house. That we'd wait until we left the house to talk about ghost of a dream. But then we wake up with ideas in the middle of the night and then we have to talk about them. And, you know, it's tough because we see each other all day, all night. And we work together, play together.
I think that we also are really both good at saying what we really mean and then forgiving whatever the other one says. We're good at like getting it out there and fighting hard for what we think is the right thing, and then coming back to the table and figuring out how to compromise. And through those compromises, we, I think, make better art because we're really truthful with each other and we can tell each other exactly how we feel something is being read or how it gets taken. And sometimes it takes a moment to negotiate that, and sometimes it can happen immediately. But yeah, we're good at letting things roll off our backs too.
I imagine that's probably the core skill. So, you know, when you gain a level of success creating one kind of work, these large scale works, for example, these public work, these works that that have a public meaning, is there pressure to continue to create that kind of work so that you're consistently branding and then not deviate from that path? I mean, does it typecast you? Or do you feel that there's enough flexibility that you can kind of branch out in a number of different directions?
I mean, I feel that's what we do best, is we branch out. I think we started by doing that lottery ticket work and then felt a little bit pigeonholed being called lottery ticket artists and really didn't want that, and started branching out from there. And I think that's what keeps us really interested in making the work still, is to be able to constantly be researching new materials and new ways of working and figuring out how to do the next project and how to do it the best way possible, and not being limited by our materials or the processes that we know how to do.
I feel like it keeps the studio exciting too, the way we continue to branch out. I feel like every new project we start, we learn new things in the studio. Like, we're always learning new tools and new ways to make things, to do these things we haven't done before, and it keeps it, like, super fun. Hopefully, like, it carries through in the artwork, but it's just fun in the making as well.
I think we do have some rules that keep it somewhat consistent, so I don't know if that helps, but we are cognizant that we want to have some sort of path, even though the work may look different. The content of the work has a thread that winds its way through everything.
Well, I'm going to ask you a little bit about your branding, but first, for our audience, the Clark Ewlings Fund delivers podcast courses like this at the pleasure of our audience. And that means if you're finding value in what you're hearing, a gift of $15 per month would be a welcome and appropriate way to sponsor this show's ongoing broadcast. Know also that a portion of our funding goes to deliver direct education to artists who've demonstrated a clear, achievable plan for transforming their businesses into self-sustaining and thriving ones that fill the world with art. Share this commitment with us now at clarkewlingsfund.org/thrive. That's clarkewlingsfund.org/thrive. We certainly appreciate it. Now, is utilizing these objects that seem to represent opulence a part of your branding? And given that, you know, you're playing this out on an international stage, you've received international recognition, is that branding being widely understood at an international level?
Adam, you want to start that?
Go ahead.
I think, yeah. I mean, I think that we've found when we say the name Ghost of a Dream that people say, oh, we know who you are. You do this, this, and this. And I think that's always exciting to us. I don't know if this relates to the question or not, but it's a little bit challenging when you have a moniker for a name to introduce yourself, because you don't always feel like saying, hi, I'm Lauren Watts from Ghost of the Dream, because it, you know, often feels a little funny. But once people know that who you are, then you can start having better conversations.
Yeah, well, I like that. I think a lot of people envy that, you know. I think they want to say something like, I'm John Smith of the Monkees, you know, or or something like that, you know. You know our band. You know, I think it's a great thing to do as artists, if it represents what you're passionate about. So let me ask you this. Let me ask you a question about the art world overall. Do you think that it's unsustainable the way it is? And I know that's a pretty broad question, but, you know, things are changing with the growth of digital media, with the growth of online markets and other things. So talk to me about the art world as it stands. Is it here to stay? It's bedrock. Is it going to evolve? Is it unsustainable? And why?
I think it's tough. And that's what this whole project is about, the sustainability. And, you know, is it going to get lost in the fog? Is it still going to be there when the fog clears? And when the fog clears, if we're saying it's going to look like something different, right? So what's that going to be? You know, even if you just look at New York, the neighborhood keeps changing, and it's based on rent, and it's based on, you know, should all the good galleries be together? And we're kind of, that's what the whole project's about. For me, at least. Why?
Yeah, I mean, I think there'll always be galleries. I think that they come and go in stages. I think that art fairs in general, I don't think that they can be sustainable in the level that we have them now. I think that it's just, there's too much movement. There's too much that they're asking of their dealers to have to travel to 10 different locations, you know, all over the world in a given year, and to get collectors to follow them to all these places. I think that people are getting burnt down on them. I don't think they've slowed down yet, but I think that we'll see another model coming up soon.
So if you could change one thing about the art world, what would that be and why?
This is your turn to answer first, Dave.
See, he throws you to the wolves every time. When he doesn't want the question, he's the gentleman then. When he doesn't want the question, he's like, Lauren, you go ahead. You know, take it, baby.
Go ahead.
What would we change about the art world?
Yeah, what would you change about the art world if you could change whatever you wanted? Or do you love it the way it is, just the way you are?
No, I don't love it the way it is, and I don't know if I have a fix for it. And maybe that's a good thing, right? That it's just we don't know what would make it better, but we all have this like appetite to improve it, and we just want to make more things to discuss the world, and we constantly...
We lost him
there. Okay. I think that what I don't like about the art world is these levels of pretension that happen about this, you know, if you're not showing or if you're not at a certain tier, then I'm going to, you know, you're going to be made to feel this way. I think that we need to somehow level the playing field and be able to just have conversations as people and not have that feeling when you walk into a blue chip gallery space that like they're judging you or you're getting looked at funny because you're not in that same tier. So somehow being able to create dialogue across many different platforms that somehow level the playing field in a better, more egalitarian way.
So you guys have worked together as a team for nearly 10 years, and you talked about one of the benefits of that being, of course, that you can split studio time and business admin time more easily. But what are some of the other benefits of having a partner in crime, so to speak? I mean, is this a course that you recommend to other artists that they form partnerships, or do you look at it and sort of say, no, never again?
I mean, I think there's great benefit to it, but there's also only one paycheck coming in. So it depends on how you look at it. I mean, I think that we... have learned so much from each other. We've been able to have more dialogue than you would ever be able to have if you just had a solo artist practice. But you also have to split that with getting just one paycheck.
Yeah, I would never tell anyone they should follow this path, but I would never trade it for anything else either.
So how about we approach it this way? Would you guys ever consider becoming solo artists again? I mean, you could break off like Ringo and John Lennon.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I haven't considered it. We've done some solo work for sure throughout the project and collaborations, some minor collaborations with other people, but I'm pretty happy with what we do.
Yeah, I feel like our identity and our life and our money and everything and our love is also wrapped up in this work of Ghost of a Dream. And I think that we are really invested in what's going to come and happen in the future that, I don't want to separate. Don't divorce me.
Well, no. So you've tied the career and the romance together in some interesting ways. And that's, you know, it's really challenging for a lot of people to do. You know, they say if you want to break up with your spouse, just go into business together. If you want to lose your friend, just start a company. And but you guys, somehow you've got the secret sauce. And of course, I know that is going to make our listeners curious. But, you do make some works on the side to support your art business, right? You do some side solo projects in addition to, I think you were saying.
Yeah.
Go ahead,
Anna. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Oh, well, we started another joint venture where we have an artist residency program that happens in Italy once a year, which is another business that we started with one other artist, Giada Crispels, who's an Italian woman. And Adam started, you want to talk about art for artists?
I also recently started an artist exchange program, so artists can exchange work with other artists, and I'm kind of just acting as the curator for that. So they ask 8 artists to make 12 works. There are 8 artists to make 11 works. So everybody gets 8 works back, and the organization gets 3 works, one for a permanent collection so it can be exhibited, and then 2 for benefits to help fund the organization.
Well, so it's not so much solo works on the side. You're not each cutting your own album, so to speak. Sorry for all the Beatles metaphors, but you co-founded an artist residency program in Italy called Art Garda, and then mm-hmm. I think you said that the artist exchange program was called Art for Artists.
Correct, Art for Artists.
Art for Art. Yeah. So can you fill in some of the gaps? Like, give our audience some sense of what these programs are like and why you went for this.
I started Art for Artists because as artists, we always are really into the work of other artists, but we're maybe not making so much that we can attain that work. So the best way I've found throughout my whole life is to trade for work. And a lot of times we don't want to ask other artists to trade for work. So I figured, why not try and curate groups of work that I think has a good dialogue and then ask those people if they'd be interested in trading. And so far, everybody I've approached seems to be very into the idea.
And for Art Garda, we live in Wassaic, New York half the time, and there's a residency here that we've been with since its beginning, just been involved with. And so we've really found the benefit of living and being around artist communities, finding that when you're together for a short, intense period of time, you really get to share things with other artists that you don't on a normal basis. You get them in the studio, you get to talk over dinner every night. And so we wanted to create something like that from the beginning for ourselves. And so last year was our first year of Art Garda. We're going to go again with 7 other artists. This October will be our second year.
And it was fantastic to create a reason for us to be in Italy 1 month a year.
Yeah, it doesn't hurt, right? It doesn't hurt. It's too bad your lottery Hummer is not a Hummer that you can just drive around, because I can see you tromping around. It's a Long Island. It takes a while to get around on the train. So it'd be nice to talk about Long Island. It's nice to take a Hummer. Well, so you've used in the past some of your large-scale projects, as teaching opportunities for students. And so I have a couple of questions about the teaching part of it. So what have you learned from teaching? Why do it at all? And sort of, why do it? Is it the money? Is it passion? Is it that it helps you clarify your own goals or what? And what's involved in that?
For me, teaching is, it just gets me really invested in process and how to sort of inspire and create people to start from the beginning, a lot of times I'm working with beginner students and they, don't know contemporary sculpture at all. So I get to work with them from, the ground level and introduce them to such exciting ideas. And it gets me excited and thinking about new work too.
And learning comes from teaching, right? So it's exciting to share with people because new things just come out of that,
Well, so do you think that artists who collaborate, whether it's on projects or it's in the kind of educational environments you're putting together at Art Garda or the exchange environments for art for artists, do you think that there's more potential for actual business growth for them? Or, does it divide the impetus that we have and spread it and water it down by spreading it around? Or does it multiply it? Is it exponential? Why?
I think Art Garda is a bit of networking, wouldn't you say, Lauren? I mean, you're creating these close relationships with people, and you're definitely getting to the roots of everything when you eat that many dinners together with somebody while drinking wine. That a lot of, I don't know if you call it business, but a lot of networking happens.
Yeah, ideas get shared, and then people think about each other when new opportunities come up, because that person so intimately. It's a bit like grad school once a year, where you get so involved and excited and just enthralled with what is happening in this little bubble.
And we've been collaborating out of last year's residency with a third person on a small project that would not have happened had the residency not happened.
Yeah.
Well, I want to ask you one other question before we sort of wind down the show with a couple of fun questions. And that's, when you have these long-term projects, like you do, and you talked about that the Fair Housing Project, you know, it goes into years, right? So how do you both stay interested in the project long enough to see it to completion?
I think as the project develops, we are inventing new things to do for that project. Like we started working with these fair materials, but we never thought we would make a bunch of furniture. We're working on a series of seats to watch the videos. And that, you know, that never occurred to us in the beginning, but then we realized, oh, well, we have these videos we're expecting people to watch. Why not make the furniture for them to watch? And so I feel like whenever we enter a project, we don't know what's going to happen during that project. And what keeps us excited is just adding all these new elements.
I agree.
So I guess I'm going to wind us down by just having a little fun and asking you a few questions like this. So what's next for you? What's coming up in the future? That are you planning something you haven't told us about?
Argarda in a month. So we're finishing up the Fair Housing Project, and we go to Italy for the month of October, and I think that's going to be kind of our think tank. I mean, we have a number of collections we've been working on because we have to collect things for sometimes a couple of years before we get to it. So we're still working on those collections, and those are private until we've kind of worked out all the kinks into what they are going to turn into.
And, you know, as you described, of course, even you're not totally sure, you've kind of turned project management into almost an impressionistic art form itself. You know, you build the house and you think, wow, let's do furniture. And then you think, well, we're doing a film, let's do more furniture to watch the film about the building of the house and the furniture. And it goes on, and you're sort of creating it as you go. So I bet you probably couldn't give us a lot of detail about where it's going to be. We just know it's going to be interesting and creative. So let me come at it from the other end. Fast forward to the future. Where do you two see yourself in 10 years?
Lauren, I've been taking a lot of the previous questions.
He dumps all the hard ones on you.
I know,
and,
right?
You know, and then I mean, he's quick to speak up on the easy ones.
Well, it'll be tough because that'll be post-Whitney and Venice Biennale, it's for sure. We'll have an 11-year-old daughter at that time, or a 10 and a half year old daughter at that time.
Who will be an awesome studio assistant. I'm planning it right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think you said earlier, very opinionated as well, so.
Yeah. She'll be getting in on the collaboration. I think that, you know, I would love to be well established teaching at an awesome school by then. We've sort of put our teaching a little bit on hold because we've been moving all over the world, focusing on work. So I would like to settle down at some great school, and be able to keep that going while doing our practice full time and just keep reinventing what we're making and keeping the ideas fresh and flowing.
I guess a major goal of mine is to just become more a part of the contemporary conversation, to help drive the conversation of the art world and what's happening and what's important in the world and what can we talk about. How can we do that through our artwork?
Yeah, I think recently we've been taking a little bit more political stand on some things, and I'm excited about those directions as well.
I think a lot of people have. It's going to be an interesting year in that regard.
For sure.
And interesting for the impact on the art world. So two more questions, and then we can kind of close her down today and call it a good show. So from when you first started, if we could rewind now and ask you to go back years, from when you first started out as artists and as an artistic team, if you knew then what you know now, and you could go back and just do one thing differently, what would it be?
Hmm. Well, I think that we started off by just asking impossible things to happen, and they did. And so I guess instead of going back and changing it, I want to put that back in our heads and keep throwing things out there to people, asking the impossible and hoping that they come true.
That's better than anything I can say. That's perfect.
See, he yielded again. There you go. All right. So I have one other question. This is, when you look at each other as cohorts on the same team, if you had to sum up what the other person's superpower is, you know, what they really bring, what they really contribute, where they shine, where the team couldn't exist without them, what is that superpower? What do they bring to the table?
Lauren's is positive energy, keeping the project going.
And I think Adam is like a total overall planning genius. He sees all of the moving parts and makes them stay in a line, where I am a very narrow focused person and and can concentrate on one thing very intently, but he is a mastermind of keeping all the details straight and making sure all the business happens.
You've been listening to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hulings Fund for Visual Artists. For more information on Ghost of a Dream, visit ghostofadream.com. For more information on the Clark Hulings Fund and our Business Accelerator Program, visit clarkhulingsfund.org. And be sure and follow our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Thank you for listening, and thank you, Adam and Lauren of Ghost of a Dream. It's been really great having you.
Thank you.
That's fantastic.